From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. Yes, it is, Thursday, May the 7th, 2020, and we've got a good full show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking first to a couple of Vermont educators. I've been meaning to get teachers onto the program here to reflect a little bit about what has school been like, or no school been like, or remote online school been like. We're going to find out exactly what to call it and all about it in just a couple of moments. And then we're going to be talking to the New England chief of FEMA in the second half hour, talking about that agency's role in the coronavirus crisis response. And later on, we've got two folks from the UVM Extension Service to visit with us. This is part of our regular Thursday Seeds to Society segment that we do with the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont, as well as a farmer from Fairley. We're going to be talking about local food systems and how they can help in the response to worries that our national food system may be on pretty thin legs, shall we say. But we'll get to all that in the second hour. First, I wanted to focus on education this morning, obviously a crucial thing that we do in our society here, preparing the next generation for making the kinds of decisions that, that no one expected to have to make 4 or 5 months ago before this coronavirus hit. And one of the decisions that got made back in March was to close Vermont's schools for the balance of the school year and to try to teach kids from a distance. And we're going to find out from a couple of teachers how that is going so far. Barb Griffin is a teacher in the elementary school in one of the elementary schools in the Rivendell School District. That's an interesting bi-state school district down in the Connecticut River Valley. It actually includes a couple of New Hampshire and a couple of Vermont towns. And Barb Griffin, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dave.
And Will Adams is an elementary Wick, Vermont, and he is also on the line with us this morning. Will, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And let me start, if I could, with I guess I'll start with Barb and ask you, Barb, when you first became aware of the pandemic, how did you – there was a period of time back in March, I think, when folks were saying, are the schools going to close? A lot of people were saying, gee, the schools should close. And what were those days like for you?
It was really hard to wrap our heads around what was happening. It's because it's never happened in our lifetimes before. And there was a lot of worry, a lot of anxiety. What platforms are we going to use? Do kids have internet connectivity? I mean, there were all kinds of issues that this created that we weren't prepared for.
Yeah, and Will Adams, I'm thinking, one of the issues would be you are maybe even more so than Barb Griffin down there in the Connecticut River Valley, but Will, you are in a district based in Hardwick that is known for a lot of economic struggle, frankly, and I wondered whether rural, economically struggling districts were going to be able to actually provide online education to kids. But in talking with you yesterday, it sounds like all that worked out better than I might have expected. So tell us what happened.
Well, I guess I would echo what Barb said. The early days, I remember distinctly having a conversation with our school superintendent on Friday the 13th of all days, when it became clear that the state was looking towards perhaps dismissing the schools or even closing them. One of the first things that our supervisory union did was to do a technology audit of all of our students to see, what the needs were. We have a really diverse supervisory union. It makes up the towns of Hardwick, Woodbury, Wolcott, Craftsbury, Standard. I hope I haven't missed any. I might have. Greensboro. But in any case, it's a really diverse district. It's very rural, and there are many spots within the supervisory union that don't have reliable access to the internet. So in some cases, it's been a challenge. But, you know, one of the things we do as teachers is to learn how to be flexible. And I think if ever there has been a case where our ability to be flexible has been put to the test, it's been this.
Yeah. Barb, let me ask you, I would gather that in your district, perhaps, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but is internet service reasonably reliable throughout your district, and B, are most families, up on modern technology?
Well, that's a great question. So it depends. Our district is diverse as well. We have some pockets that have great internet access, so we're served by EC fiber, which is fiber optic, but it only it doesn't reach everybody. So the people it doesn't reach really struggle with internet connectivity issues, as well as having access to laptops or computers or the devices able to be able to learn remotely from home. So it depends on the students, and some of our staff have issues too connecting.
Yeah, Barb. Will told me yesterday that of course he's a sixth grade teacher, and I'm wondering what grades do you teach?
I'm a K to four reading teacher.
Wow! So you're really dealing with the small kids,
and which is fun. It's a lot of fun, but it does bring its challenges, particularly with remote learning.
Well, I was going to ask about that because, you know, a lot of 6-year-olds are pretty squirmy. I don't know if that's a technical educational term, but how do you keep them parked in front of a computer screen long enough to get through a reading lesson?
Well, the first couple lessons were challenging. I had my first lesson was with a student on a cell phone, and the cell phone was way too mobile. I was getting sick just watching where we were going. And from that lesson, I learned I have to first just spend the first couple lessons just listening to the kids and let them show me what they want to show me, because they're all excited about showing me their dog, their cat, or whatever it may be. And then after we got through that, I spoke with the parents and just said, if you could have them on a laptop, that way they're not as mobile, that is helpful. And trying to find activities that are engaging or lessons that are engaging, that's been a challenge, because we want kids to be engaged in it.
Do you find that there's a sort of a shortage of curriculum that is designed, A, for that age group, and B, for online learning?
I don't think there's so much a shortage as there is access to it. When this first started, I didn't know any of the platforms that were out there, any of the programs that were out there, or any of the options, because I didn't use them. But then I got inundated with thousands of them, so just vetting them and trying to figure out what is the best one for this particular student or for our school district, and is it free or how much is it cost? A lot of people have been very generous in terms of publishers, and they have given, during this COVID-19 period, they have given students and schools free online access for sometimes it's 15 days, sometimes it's 30 days, sometimes it's the end of June. That has been very helpful in trying to figure out what materials are actually going to meet the needs of our students and that are
available. I would gather you'd want to test them for longer periods than these companies. Some of them, I'm sure, are sort of in the traditional mindset of a lot of online services, where they give you a week or two for free and then you're expected to start paying for it. Will Adams, I'm wondering, in your case, do you feel like you were already fully up to speed on things like Google Classroom and the other platforms I'm hearing about, or has this been a big learning curve for you?
Well, teaching sixth grade, I have used Google Classroom for several years, so my kids are adept at using those kind of platforms. I would echo what Barb said, that a lot of the vendors have been very generous in terms of providing access to the different platforms that can be used online. You know, I do want to touch on one thing. You know, we talk about meeting students' needs. The one thing that we really haven't talked about is their social-emotional needs. And, you know, this, whether we want to, whether we acknowledge it or not, this is traumatic for everybody to varying degrees. And kids, you know, they thrive on structure, and they thrive on the connection that they have with their friends and their teachers at school. So, you know, my experience was, and I'm grateful for my superintendent because he made very clear early on that his priority for not only teachers but also faculty and staff was our well-being. So, you know, during the initial period of closure, we put a lot of effort into making sure that we were connected with our kids. And I'm not going to say that we tried to make things as normal as we could, because I think normal is relative and there's nothing normal about what we're going through. But what we did do was create, you know, regular structures and regular routines. I have video morning meetings with my class every day. And it's just having that kind of connection. I noticed from my students in particular early on that their biggest need was that connection and being connected to their friends, connected with me, and having some sense that things were going to be okay.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point, because I think kids, adults too, you get into a daily routine. I mean, for kids, it's almost like their job is to go to school, and a lot of their activities are geared toward, you know, the activities of school and the people they're going to see there. And as you say, their friends and their teachers and kind of the network of personalities they connect to, or to a greater or lesser degree. And all of that, all of a sudden, a lot of that stuff, or just about all of it, is pulled away. That's got to be pretty disorienting. Barb Griffin, I'm wondering if you found that same kind of disorienting nature for the younger kids.
Oh, absolutely. And just echoing what Will said, our district did the same thing. The primary goal is the students' social and emotional well-being and making their needs met. So this, the academics is secondary. We've too created a system where we make sure that students have a safety net, and dividing the school up amongst not just the classroom teachers but other people within the building to make the caseload small enough that you can really focus on students and their families. And we have weekly check-ins and a system for recording the check-ins. And then we can look for trends within students. If we see that one particular student or family isn't checking in or they're not completing the work, then we can contact the family and see if their needs are being met. Do they have enough food? Are they, do they feel safe? What can we do to help them? And parents and families have responded incredibly well to this. Just yesterday we had a parade with teachers and the fire trucks. The town of West Fairleigh led the parade, and the Berkshire fire truck was in the parade. And we did all the bus routes, which took us about 2 hours to do. And we had it was interesting, because it was eerily lonely because of social distancing. We all drove our own vehicles, so the parade was long. But we couldn't talk to anybody because we're out of cell service. So, but the kids were by the roads, and parents had signs, and it was just so exciting to see them. And they were incredibly excited to see us as well.
That's great. That must have been really nice. Just a nice warm feeling to see all the, you know, there's such and such a kid there, and you know, and your last memory of the kid was probably in a classroom in February, and now you're thinking, well, the kid is still there, maybe grown another couple inches or something, but that's got to be nice. Will, I'm wondering, and I'm going to actually put this question to both of you, because I gather you might have different takes on it. You know, some people have sort of fantasized over the years about how online learning is going to, going to make its way into education and I can even imagine in certain limited ways. You know, you can imagine a high school language class or something, where, you know, maybe kids could be online for a couple out of the 5 days of the week or something. for the purposes of that class. Now, obviously, there are other classes and schedule issues and all the rest of it. But do you think that this is going to be a precursor of a future in which online education is going to be a bigger piece of the school program in Vermont?
Well, I guess what I would say is that technology has its place, and I think we would really, we'd be missing an opportunity if we didn't take this pandemic as an opportunity to step back and reflect on what we do as schools. Now, I don't think that technology is by any means the end-all be-all for education. Particularly from the elementary school's perspective, a huge part of what we do is the social-emotional teaching and helping kids to learn how to navigate relationships, how to navigate their own feelings, how to grow into responsible citizens. And, as human beings, we're hardwired to communicate in ways that are much more nuanced than an online platform can provide. One of the things that I'm finding is that as nice as it is to be able to see my students or my colleagues on a computer screen, their presence on a computer screen highlights their absence. And it's really disorienting. And, anybody who has spent any time in a classroom, anybody who has spent any time in a school understands that there is an energy and a connection that's created between teachers and students that you just can't replicate online. Now, I don't mean any of this to be dismissive of the role of technology, but I think we really need to take this as an opportunity to think really clearly about what is our role as public schools. Why are we there? Is it simply to try to impart knowledge on them, or do we serve a greater purpose? And I would argue that we serve a greater purpose that can't be fulfilled online.
Yeah, here's something that occurred to me a few years ago. I've read a little bit of like philosophy of communications and stuff, just being a journalist by background and somebody who's in the communications business. You think about the words media and immediate. Obviously, immediate is going to be the opposite of something related to media. You just think for the basic structure of those words, and you start to realize that in the case of a computer screen, that is a medium. That's a form of media, and what you lose looking at somebody in the computer screen is its opposite, which is immediacy, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think there is an absence of a counter, or not a an absence of an intervening entity there that stands between you and the other person. In what you just described, the computer screen in mass media, it's the television, it's the television whole broadcast system, or it's the radio broadcast system, or it's, it's kind of interesting to me that the words play out the way they do, because I think language can sometimes tell us something, but I do digress a bit. Barb, talk to me a little bit about, at your level, what do you think about technology as either a helpful or hindering force in your daily educational life?
Well, I totally have to agree with Will, and I do think that there's a balance between the technology piece and the social and emotional piece. And, it brings me back to one of my favorite books, that All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a collection of poems that basically talks about what Will was talking about, is that social-emotional piece, how kids interact, playing fairly, sharing everything, put things where you found them. I mean, those types of things, when you hurt somebody, say you're sorry. Online, it is very challenging to do that. And I think, students need to learn how to read other people's body language. when they're having conversations with them or they're out in the playground with them. I think that that social contact is critical for kids' development. So I do think it that is important, and it does need to be balanced with the technology piece.
Yeah, I almost wish I'd brought in a high school teacher here, because it would be interesting to get a perspective kind of from the other end of the K-12 pipeline. But I'm wondering, maybe Will, you know, you could talk to us a little bit about this. Does that face-to-face learning and the social interaction and, you know, the idea of putting things back where you found them? Actually, I know some teenagers who still need to hear that from time to time. But anyway, Will, does it get easier to apply technology as the kids get older?
Yes and no. I mean, teaching sixth grade, I mean, sixth graders, it's a transitional time of their lives. And, you know, different schools are configured differently. I teach in a pre-K to sixth school. In some school districts, sixth grade is in the middle school. You know, I find, you know, one of the biggest challenges that my kids are struggling with, and I struggle with as their teacher, is that this is their last year in elementary school, and this is one of the first big transitions in their lives. And to a student, they're all asking, what's the end of the school year going to look like? How are we going to close this out? And to not have that sense of closure, it's really difficult for everybody who's involved. So, I mean, does the technology get any easier? You know, they become more fluent with it, but that presents its own challenges. You know, I find that a lot of the times, I'm teaching students who have, you know, they've grown up with technology. A lot of the teaching that I have to do around technology is how to use it critically and how to use it thoughtfully. You know, one of the things that I've been doing a lot of small group work with my students, and they will share their screen with me through a Google Meet, so I can see, they're in charge of the screen, so I can see what they're doing, and kind of the speed with which they will scroll up and down on a page and watching their cursor just kind of float all over the screen, it highlights that they really need explicit instruction in, just like in a book, how you preview a book. When you get to a web page, how do you preview it? Rather than just scrolling up and down, how do you look at it critically? So, I mean, there's a lot that can be taught and needs to be taught about the use of technology.
Also, I would gather that you know, people talk about becoming an astute user of technology. In other words, you know, understanding, for instance, when to be skeptical about what you're seeing on social media, understanding, and you're right, just all of the sort of the techniques of knowing what the patterns are in the way the various software systems present themselves to the user, so that you're not struggling to figure out where am I going in this thing to get to the next layer or whatever. So I think there are some issues there for sure. And I'm wondering, you know, as you look forward to next fall, I'm going to put this to both of you too, and we are getting a little short on time here, but I wanted to ask Barb, do you expect and think that school will be sort of "quote unquote" back to normal as you open up for fall, or and if so, or to what degree will it have changed? Do you think as a result of all this?
I would really love school to be back to normal, but I don't think that will happen. And there are so many variables involved with school going back to normal. When our children return, we have to assess and see where they are. Are their needs being met? Do they have resources? Do the parents still have their jobs? Do they feel safe? Do they have financial stability? And I think that's the starting point we have to be at. And I also think we need to work collaboratively together with our superintendents and the school community and parents to see, okay, what is this going to look like, and how can we work together to make sure all of our students' needs are being met, and we meet them where they are, not where we want them to be, but where they are, and that.
Just a minute or so to go, so I hate to interrupt, but Will, what's your answer? What's Hardwick Elementary School going to look like in September?
Well, I think we're making some assumptions about whether school will be starting in September. I certainly hope that it will. And I would caution against using normal. I would lean towards the idea of, you know, returning to a brick and mortar learning environment. I'll echo what Barb said. There will be nothing normal about going back to the brick and mortar school. There's going to be a lot of needs. There's going to be a lot of need on the part of the adults to, you know, assess where the kids are. And I don't mean academically, like checking in with them to make sure that they're emotionally okay, and make sure that their family is stable. I think we make a mistake if we go into this thinking that the return to brick and mortar school is going to be like the start of any other school year. I think the needs are going to be much, much more acute, and we have to be ready for it.
Wow, that is a challenge. And the two of you, Barb Griffin, Will Adams, both public school teachers in Vermont, I wish you and your colleagues all the best in trying to work your way through it. I can hear you telling us it's not going to be easy, but it's certainly noble work, and I commend you in it. And keep the faith, shall we say? How's that? Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Let's go to a bottom of the hour break on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and we will be back. We'll be talking to the head of FEMA for New England in the second half hour.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into this second half hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And I'm going to take just a minute to remind you all of our podcasts. We had a really interesting conversation, I think, in the first half hour of the show this morning with a couple of Vermont school teachers about what it's been like to try to keep things going on the educational front in this time of school shutdowns and distance learning and all the rest of that. And Barb Griffin of the Rivendell District, these are both elementary school teachers. Also, Will Adams of Hardwick Elementary School were my guests. And I thought really thoughtful and interesting perspectives on their work to try to keep, as I say, the kids learning, even when the kids are not in school. So if you missed any of that, you are always welcome to go to our podcast. WDEVradio.com is the homepage of the station. Just follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit and you will come across a list of our recent programs by topic, usually, and by guest. And you can listen to your heart's content on the internet any time of day or night, weekends, you name it, whenever you want, feel like tuning in and listening to a little talk radio. It doesn't have to be between 9 and 11 on weekday mornings when we are live on the air here. So, hey, wanted to hope I can introduce my next guest, I think we're going to be speaking in just a couple of moments to Captain W. Russ Webster. He is with FEMA and is actually the regional administrator for New England with FEMA. And that agency is actually taking an important role in coordinating the responses of other federal agencies to the COVID-19 crisis that we're all experiencing here in the world, and including in the United States of America, and of course in Vermont. And so it'll be interesting to get the perspective of somebody who is looking New England wide. I might want to ask him if he does, since he does have this six state perspective, Why is it that Vermont actually seems to be doing quite a bit better than some of our neighboring states? Massachusetts has had thousands of deaths, and Vermont, I think, right now is still in the neighborhood of 50, and that is rather striking. I mean, that's a huge difference, even for a state that is 11 times the size of Vermont's population. Massachusetts has had a number of deaths which far outstrips even that difference. And so maybe the regional administrator with FEMA can help us out and explain to us what are the factors involved there. We still have not made contact, however, with our regional FEMA director. Maybe he's responding to another emergency this morning. I'm not sure what's going on with him. And I think in the meantime, maybe what we should do is open up the phone lines and ask listeners to call in with your thoughts just about whatever is going on in the news this morning. Certainly, there's a never-ending, constant stream of news out of Washington, D.C., out of the nation at large. I'm looking at my Apple News feed right now, and the leading headline is, America begins to reopen, but some businesses and customers are in no rush to get back. And actually, that prompts a question that I'm interested in getting perspective from some listeners out there. Even if we relax the strictures that we've all been living under, are you eager to get out and go out and socialize and hang out in restaurants or bars, or go shopping and take sort of voluntary trips to the big box to get whatever is on sale this week? Be interested to hear about that. I believe we have a caller from Hardwick. Did I hear Karen?
Hi, Dave. Did you listen to Bill Sayre's program Friday or Monday?
I did not. No, I got on both days. I got tied up with the news conference right afterward, and then I have some other work in the afternoon. So on the delayed broadcast days, it's tough.
Maybe you could go back and listen to it. He had a wonderful doctor on talking about oxidative therapies, and they actually do inject intravenous disinfectants. And it sounds very plausible and very affordable. And the explanation...
I'm sorry, and they actually do inject what?
Intravenous disinfectant, which is, it's not like Lysol, it's oxygen-based, ozone.
Hmm.
And the reason he gave for it not being used by the medical community is there's no money in it. A treatment costs $1. So I just think it would be worth you going back and having a listen, because you were ridiculing Trump for saying it, and there might be something to it.
Well, that's probably a worthwhile thing. I will check that out and see. This is a Dr. Owen, I believe.
No, Dr. Robert
Rowan.
Rowan. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. And ozone is a form of disinfectant.
Well, it's ozone, hydrogen peroxide. He calls it oxidative therapies. And there's an American Academy of Oxidative Therapy. It all sounds
okay.
Worth looking into. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Karen. And the folks out there are really curious about I think the thing that Karen referred to there was the president coming out a couple weeks ago and talking about injection of disinfectants, and that got a lot of it did get a fair amount of ridicule and so on, because I don't think it was certainly not very well explained, because when people think of disinfectants, of course, the most natural response to that is what we've all grown up thinking of and using of and being bombarded with advertisements for. And that is things like Clorox and Lysol and other things like that. And so I don't know that perhaps the president needed to be clear that he wasn't talking about household disinfectants, but a therapy involving an ozone-based medical therapy. I don't know it sounds like, from what Karen was just saying, that this technique has been in use for a while. So there you go. Maybe there's something to be pulled away from that whole discussion about disinfectants after all. So let's go to another caller. Joanne is ringing in from Worcester. Good morning, Joanne.
Morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. No, I just wanted to make a comment about that oxygen therapy, because I listened to that program too. And I have been a dental hygienist for 42 years. I also have a bachelor's in biological sciences. And I'm listening to this. I'm listening to this man talking. I'm going, wait a minute, this is like not right. And what really set me off was he talked about the way it's called ozone oxygen gas therapy, and the way that it works, according to him, is it disrupts the mitochondrial function in viruses, and viruses don't have mitochondria, so there's no way this would work on a virus the way he said. So I actually got online afterwards and researched it, and this therapy has very limited proof of working. It is prohibited by the FDA. It exacerbates respiratory conditions, especially asthma and COPD, and it causes certain types of cancer. Ozone has been known to cause certain types of cancer. And I'm just like, I don't see how this would work. I have something about injecting gas into intravenously into a body is just not right.
Well, Joanne, obviously I think you offer a valuable counter perspective here from the last call we got, and that's one of the things we like to do on the program here, is to get competing points of view out there and let listeners decide who is most reliable or what makes the most sense, and that is I'm calling that making progress. So thank you so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Okay, well, there's a. There is an interesting piece of discussion right there, I'd say. Let's go to Bill in Waitsfield. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Dave. If the FEMA person does show up, there's one question that I I'd like to ask, and it has to do with. Well, I was listening to Peter Welch the other day talking about the checks going out to the folks that don't have direct deposit. And then that's going to be like another, I don't know if it's a total of 2 months or another 2 months beyond now. But FEMA gets, on natural disasters, they get checks into people's hands often within a day or two, which is, which is often on a fairly massive scale, certainly not the whole country like we're looking at now. But just the regular things when inspectors come in and they send the information back into FEMA, those checks go right out, and I was involved somewhat with that, so very often I'd see people on the street a day after having inspected their houses, and they say they'd say I just got a check, I was amazed.
And so
you would think that if that mechanism is there, and particularly it was even on a broader scale, in Katrina and Rita, they were giving, it was intended to be $2,000 per family, but people were managing to, get applications in where there were sometimes several to a household, and which wasn't really the way it was designed or intended. But those checks were going out. We even had applications coming from jails, people wanting to get $2,000 checks.
Wow. Bill, I think you raise an interesting point here. And it sounds like maybe FEMA, if it's not involved, could be more involved in this kind of thing. I would say, though, that in typically FEMA is responding to a localized natural disaster. Say Tropical Storm Irene, and Irene didn't hit all areas of Vermont. It hit some communities very hard, others it largely spared. In this current pandemic, the whole country, every state, every community is affected, and that is a different picture, I think, completely from
the scale. So fairly massive, but I don't really know what the mechanism is, but I know that that for the individual areas, in some cases, when Florida had five storms going at once, and that was a real active season, those checks weren't delayed. You know, so
I don't know, that's interesting.
If expanded to take that in, or it's just a matter of it having to go through a different agency.
Well, that would be a good question for the FEMA director if we can get him, but I'm starting to have my doubts about this morning anyway, because, oh, well, that's the way it goes sometimes. Bill, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Bill in Waterbury. I'm sorry, Dick in Waterbury.
Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
You know, Trump has declared himself many things during this whole pandemic, one of which is that early on he declared himself a wartime president.
Yeah.
And if you think about and look at the numbers, Vietnam went on for a number of years, and there were thousands of people, you know, that unfortunately lost their lives.
Yeah.
This pandemic.
About 56,000, if I remember correctly, of U.S. troops.
Yeah. This pandemic has gone on for 4 months, and now we've lost over 73,000.
Yeah.
So I think he probably better. Get a different choice of words, because if he's a wartime president, God help us.
You know, I think that's a really interesting, interesting thought, because I've heard some people argue too that we, in terms of this balance between getting the economy back raring to go, as the president describes it, versus trying to protect the public health and all that. You know, occasionally I'll hear somebody say something like, "Well, gee whiz." People have gone to war and died for the American way of life, which in no small part means the American economy for centuries now. And maybe we just have to be prepared from time to time to make a pretty significant national sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not endorsing that argument. I'm just saying that's something that I've heard people say. But then when you compare the kind of pace and the numbers here, it is, I think the Civil War still is our deadliest war, 600,000 American lives lost. Of course, that was between different sections of America. So it makes sense that it would have been the deadliest for Americans. And that was over 4 years. At this pace, it would be a much bigger deal by the time 4 years elapsed if the current pace continues. God help us. Let's hope it doesn't. But
there you go.
So, okay. Hey, I appreciate the call, Dick. Thanks. Okay. Thanks for that thought. Interesting. And let's see. One more caller on the line, I believe. Mike, good morning.
Morning, Dave. I got a different perspective on looking at this a little bit. Put your blinders on and you can't see anything but the state of Vermont. That's all you see. You know nothing about what's going on outside. And last I knew, we had about 660,000 people in Vermont population.
Yep.
Now, we're locking down 659,950 people. So can you see where the frustration comes from? We're locking down 659,950 people because 50 people died.
So you're saying we've gone way too far in on this sort of balance where the teeter-totter is sloped completely to one side.
I think we should put it in perspective and, like other states, look where the problem was. You know, most of it all happened up in Burlington and down near the Mass border where other states were coming into our state. But we're locking down a hell of a lot of people for 50 people to die. We lose that many people on our highways every year. Well, we don't lock down the whole state. I'm just saying that perspective-wise, we're locking down a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the counter argument you would hear from Mark Levine, the Commissioner of Health, or other state officials who are watching this and involved in this, is they would tell you that one of the reasons we have had, thankfully, a low death rate so far from the coronavirus pandemic here in Vermont is because we've locked down. That if we hadn't been as restrictive as we have been, the death rate would be considerably higher. I think you're also hearing from them that that we need to keep up our defenses and maybe not keep the economy in the kind of lockdown it's been in for the last couple of months, but certainly.
I agree with what they've done. I'm just saying if this is where the frustration comes from everybody else.
Yeah, I get you. I understand.
You have no talent. One death is too many. But yep. You get these towns that haven't even been affected yet, and they can't say why. Well,
yeah,
I walked in my village, so that's where I think where you see all the frustration comes from.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. You know, obviously, there are competing perspectives here, and that's frequently what happens in public discourse. So there you go. Hey, let's go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. We'll be hearing from a correspondent from Axios after the top of the hour, and on to the Seeds to Society segment in the second hour. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour this morning. And we'd like to lead off the second hour with one of our national correspondents. And this morning it's Steph Kite from Axios, axios.com. Terrific online news site, axios.com. You can go there and really get a quick but thorough dip into the daily news, and also a lot of interesting features and trend stories, stuff going on out there. They cover a whole lot of different topics. Fascinating stuff. I recommend it highly. Steph Kite, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Hey, one story that really caught my eye on Axios today was. It says here, the America's rate of new coronavirus cases peaked in early April, but rather than declining sharply, as in Italy and Spain, it plateaued. We're still recording several times more new cases each day than any other country has on any single day during this pandemic. Those are scary facts, and I'm wondering, what are Italy and Spain doing that we're not doing and might want to emulate?
Yeah, you know, this data is certainly eye-opening. I think a lot of people have been looking at the national trends and thinking that, you know, we're on the downhill now, and that the cases are falling. But, you know, if you look at the story that we did today that you're mentioning, when you take New York out of the equation, where, you know, New York had a surge of cases and has been able to see those cases start to decline, if you take New York out of the picture, the U.S. case numbers are still growing, which is, of course, something that's frightening, especially as we're starting to see states talk about reopening and how we can get the economy going again. And, you know, there's so many different factors that add to this. Part of this is just the fact that the U.S. took so long to respond in the beginning, and that the kinds of shelter-in-place orders have been very varied by state and by area, whereas some of the European countries had stricter shelter-in-place orders that were more strictly imposed. So all these things can factor into the fact that we're seeing the U.S. Maintain fairly high case numbers and in some instances continue to grow case numbers in some states.
Yeah, and one of the things that is really kind of shaping up here is that when you when people are polled on the risks connected to coronavirus, you know, and asked things like, would you go out to eat in a restaurant right now? Would you go back to your workplace, and et cetera, et cetera? We're seeing a big divergence between Republicans and Democrats on their responses to those questions, with Democrats seemingly much more risk averse here. Is that right?
We are starting to see pretty stark partisan differences in the response to the virus, and even what people are willing to believe about the data that's being presented about the spread of the virus in the U.S. And that's something that Axios has also seen in the polling that we do with Ipsos polling. We've seen that Democrats tend to believe that the case numbers that we're seeing are actually lower than the reality. Democrats tend to think that the virus is actually doing more damage than what we're seeing in the polls, what we're seeing in the data being presented due to under testing. But on the other hand, Republicans are more likely to say that the case numbers are actually lower than what we're seeing in the polls and in the media, what we're seeing reported. Republicans think that this is being overblown for the most part, or are more likely to think that everything is being overblown than Democrats. And those thoughts and feelings are influencing whether people feel like they're ready to get back to normal life, whether people feel comfortable going to restaurants and participating in the economy or not. So we are certainly starting to see a divergence in dependent on your political party.
It's interesting to me, too, because in certain other policy discussions, let's take climate change just for one example. Republicans tend to think the risk is way overestimated. Democrats tend to think it may be underestimated. Do you see a commonality there between the view of climate change and the view of this pandemic?
You know, I think a lot of this comes down to people's individual experiences. I think people who have seen the health impacts on their communities have lived in cities that tend to be more democratic and have seen and known more people to contract the virus and die from the virus are going to be more aware of the impacts and take this more seriously and be more fearful of the health aspect of things. Whereas, you know, maybe there are Republicans living in more rural areas who haven't seen the devastation in quite the same way and are seeing more of the economic impacts rather than the health impacts from their communities. So I think that is a huge part of this, as well as, you know, many Republicans really do view the economy as their central voting issue, whereas Democrats tend to say health care is their central voting issue. And I think just looking at those voting trends and priorities also gives us a look into how different people who associate with different parties prioritize things and prioritize what they think needs to be done during the virus.
Do you think that community impact issue, let's overlap that now with the fact that, you know, you were saying if you pull New York out of the national figures, the coronavirus still is a pretty raging epidemic in your pandemic in the United States. And I'm just wondering, and of course, now we're seeing reporting from places like Nebraska and the Dakotas and so on, mm-hmm. indicating that, you know, they're really experiencing what New York was a month ago in some respects. I'm wondering if that, and we know those tend to be the redder states out on the Great Plains and so on, mm-hmm. or some of the redder states. Are we going to end up with Republicans maybe in the showing up in the polls as being less willing to dismiss the risks here?
This is certainly something that we're watching at Axios. We're waiting to see as this virus spreads, as it reaches more rural areas, which are going to be some of the last hit by the virus and the last places to see the immediate impacts from the coronavirus, whether that does change the way Republicans view it, whether it changes nationwide sentiment from each party. You know, we've already started to see even some Republican mayors start to go against the wishes of their governors and impose more social distancing rules. So we're already seeing that kind of partisan political tension of, yes, we don't want to be enforcing people to stay in their homes needlessly, you know, Republicans questioning the constitutionality of those decisions, but also starting to see the virus actually impact their communities and actually impact their constituents and realizing that something does need to be done. And, you know, I was talking to a senator just yesterday who pointed out that, yeah, we are starting to see coronavirus cases pop up in more rural areas. And it's something that could really change negotiations over the next stimulus package. It could really change the way this is playing out in the political world.
I wanted to shift our focus for a moment to the ongoing tension, it seems, between our president and the Congress, and particularly between our president and the House of Representatives, which happens to be controlled by Democrats. It certainly flared up this week with the announcement by the White House that Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease chief, would not be allowed to testify in the House, but he would be allowed to testify in front of a Senate committee. And the president was quoted in the reporting I saw this morning saying that the House is full of Trump haters. Talk to us a little bit about this. Is that ever happened before? Are presidents allowed to sort of pick and choose which chamber they send their officials over to talk to?
you know, it's obviously a political move. And, you know, President Trump has not shied away from saying these types of things, calling people Trump haters. And, you know, obviously he has lots of political tension between himself and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, we saw this throughout the impeachment process and the, you know, Russia investigation, where again and again, Trump would stop people from testifying in front of the House who or testifying in front of committees that he felt would be unfair to him. So I don't think this is surprising that President Trump would have said these things and would prefer to have Fauci testify in front of the Republican-controlled Senate rather than, you know, the Democratic-controlled House.
Yeah, I mean, I still try to put this in the context of presidents in general, you know, in modern times. I mean, what was the pattern with previous, you know, Presidents Obama, George W. Bush, Clinton, et cetera? I mean, generally, my recollection is that you had more, frankly, hostile hearings in the Congress, famously the Benghazi hearing where Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, testified, was a great example of, you know, a Democratic administration having an official go in and be grilled for, I think, what was it, 9 or 11 hours or something, by a Republican-led House committee. And you don't see as much of that anymore, it seems, because of this current approach by this administration. Is that, am I reading that right?
No, I think that's absolutely accurate. You know, I think we've seen a pattern of President Trump kind of saying the quiet part out loud and kind of acting on concerns that maybe past administrations had. I'm sure there were concerns that, you know, there would be unfair treatment or difficult questions or, you know, a grilling from Congress members of the other party. These were things that they were prepared for and considering. But of course, when it comes to President Trump, he's shown that he's not even willing to play ball in many cases, and that he would prefer to protect his image and not give the sound bites to the media. And, you know, we see again and again that the president likes to blame Democrats and blame the media for poor coverage. And we're seeing, you know, even more recently that he's not even willing to go there and that he's going to do everything in his power to prevent those kinds of stories and those kinds of, you know, moments testifying in front of Congress from happening at all.
Yep. Well, more on this sort of front to come, I'm sure. Steph Kite of Axios, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Continuing with our Seeds to Society segment that we do every Thursday from WDEV FM and AM, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont has been very helpful to us in preparing discussions every week about our food system. And food system, of course, has been getting a lot of attention just recently in the sense that there is some concern about potential national shortages of different food types. One area, of course, is in the meat industry. I saw a CEO of one of the major meat packing companies a couple of weeks ago talking about the possibility that the meat industry could be severely affected by the pandemic because a lot of folks in the meat packing plants coming down with COVID-19. And in Vermont here, there's been a lot of talk about, can we be resilient enough to kind of fill in the gaps and keep our food system going? And we have some folks from the University of Vermont Extension Service, and as well as a farmer down in the Connecticut River Valley, to talk with us about this today. I'll introduce them in the order in which they were given to me. We've got Lisa Chase, an extension professor and director of Vermont Tourism Research Center, and she's going to talk about the sort of overlap or connections between Vermont's usually vibrant tourism industry and the food systems. Jane Kolodinsky is actually a returning champion. She's been on these segments before, and professor and chair, UVM Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And she'll be talking to us about the similar issues here. And Danielle Allen is a farmer who has a farm down in Fairley, Vermont. I believe it is called the Route 5 Farm. That's spelled R-O-O-T. That's pretty good. I suspect they may be along Route 5 there in Fairley. And I want to thank the three of you for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
And let me start if I could with Lisa Chase, because your your kind of angle on this, which I think you come at it from, as I say, the overlap between perhaps tourism and agriculture. What are you seeing out there in that around that intersection, I guess I'll say, in this age of pandemic?
I primarily work with farms that are open to visitors and provide either product, direct sales, or experiences. Of course, the farms mm-hmm. that primarily focus on experiences, like overnight farm stays or U-Pick or what have you, most experiences are closed. Certainly overnight farm stays, tastings, dinners at the farm, those sorts of things are not happening for the foreseeable future. On the other hand, when it comes to getting direct product to communities, we're seeing incredible growth and interest. U-Pick, maybe we've got guidelines for U-Pick now, but in terms of farms that have been able to quickly adapt new guidelines, it's been really amazing seeing local farmers step up and provide food for their communities and seeing this incredible demand and interest from local residents.
So I'm just thinking of, if I'm imagining a farm where they've done some agritourism, maybe the overnight farm stays or the U-Picks or this sort of thing. And as you say, the farm dinners and so on, and as you say, their businesses are shut down in those respects because of the pandemic. Have they been able to fill in the gaps in terms of just income and staying economically vibrant somehow by stepping up their production of foodstuffs and getting them out to their communities? Is this kind of a transition for some from sort of agritourism and shifting the emphasis over to sort of basic agriculture?
Right. And it's the ability of farms to adapt has varied widely. For example, if you're a dairy farmer and you do overnight farm stays, there's not a lot of flexibility there. While, I'll give another farm, for example, Trillium Hill Farm up in Hinsdale, they used to sell a lot of their product to restaurants. Well, restaurants don't need it right now, so they were able to quickly, and they already had a farm stand and a CSA, so they were able to quickly shift their product for restaurants and put it towards online orders and the curbside pickup for local Vermonters.
That's interesting, and I'm wondering the let me actually go to Jane Kolodinsky here and ask you. I see in your biographical note here that some of what you study is sort of demand and consumer behavior, and one of the things I've wondered about is how close is Vermont or how far is Vermont from being able to really bump up the amount of local food people are consuming in the state if, in fact, some of our national food system were to start breaking down in any sectors of it, whether it's meat or produce or whatever you want to identify. Would Vermont, I've seen figures that are, actually, you fill me in. My best recollection is that Vermonters currently get about 12% of their food or something like that from local sources. Is that right?
Yeah, Dave, that's correct. And what I'd like to add here is that the consumer part of this equation is very, very important. Part of the impetus of asking to be on this show today or being on Seed to Society is that Lisa and I and colleagues from Washington State and California were part of a project called the Farm Fresh Food Box Project, which tried to increase the amount of local foods in households of consumers, but not exactly through direct-to-consumer, such as CSA and farm stands. It was to deliver those food boxes through retail. And what we found was that the farmers could do it, and the retailers were thrilled with it, but it was still a little bit too inconvenient and maybe a little bit more expensive for consumers who are used to just going to the supermarket, choosing what they want, and you know, fast, cheap food. And here we are during this pandemic, and consumers are finding it's not so easy just to go to the grocery store anymore. And so luckily we have these farms who are stepping in, ready, willing, and able to deliver fresh food, fresh local food to consumers, and consumers realizing they can trust their local farmer and really demanding this food. So I think, you know, this pandemic, it's a horrible situation. But for local food, I think that our local food system stepping in, especially hearing about the consolidated meat industry and so on, and that efficiency is not what it's all about anymore. It's now effectiveness. So, yeah, consumers may realize that it might be better to purchase more local foods, as even if it takes an extra step in the process. But it's healthy, it's trustful, and the farmers are stepping up.
That's great. And I mean, I think, as you say, it's a horrible situation, but doing the best we can, even in a bad situation, is that's an old story for Vermonters. And we've had challenges before and tried to rise above them. Let me bring Danielle Allen into the conversation here. And Danielle, I'm really interested in your experience here, because I saw in your biographical note that you have a background in landscape design, and you have this farm in down in Fairleigh, and I'm wondering, I'm trying to put these little pieces of evidence together, and I'm picturing a place where you invite folks in, and there may be some elements there of landscape design that maybe not be completely typical to other farms. Or tell me about that.
Oh, it's interesting that that's the detail that you grabbed onto, but that's great. Yeah, we have kind of quite a unique setup for our farm that really is defined by the railroad tracks, the railroad crossing. And so we've designed our entire farm around the fact that we don't welcome the public to our farm, actually, because it's not a public crossing over the railroad tracks.
Oh, I see. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, and so we were able to really, we've been doing this now for 8 years on this land and have built up a business around distributing our produce around the Upper Valley, everything within 30 miles, but nothing is sold on the farm. And so without really knowing it, we were preparing for this in a way, what's going on with the pandemic right now. We have set up all of our distribution system to be offsite. And so we grow, just for a little more background, we grow 38 acres of organic vegetables, and we sell our products primarily through CSA Share, Farmers Market, and to local grocery stores. So
okay.
Yeah.
And are you finding that there's more demand for your products right now? I mean, it as a wholesaler of organic vegetables, are you finding that's a really strong business right now?
Yeah, and particularly our CSA shares. The demand for our CSA shares just went through the roof. And we've just been, doing our best to adapt and keep up. But we've doubled our sales from last year. We had 180 members, and this year we have coming up on 350 members for our CSA. So
it's about double. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, in a very short time, And so we sort of shifted our markets rather than focus on farmers market, which for quite a while there was very uncertain whether it was even going to happen. We just shifted towards CSA because we knew we had a reliable model for a safe way to get our food to customers. We pre-pack all of our boxes and distribute them to essentially curbside pickup sites. And that's how we've been doing it for the past 8 years. So it wasn't a huge change for us. We were already kind of in this model and doing that system.
Well, as someone who's been in this for a while, then I'll tell you what, I do have a follow-up question I want to ask about that, but I'm going to save it for after our bottom of the hour break. We need to go hear some CBS News for a minute, and then a couple words from our sponsors. And we will continue our conversation with our friends from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and farmer Daniel Allen in just a few minutes, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. We are we have three guests actually on the line right now. Daniel Allen is a farmer in Fairley, Vermont, specializing in organic produce. We have Jane Kolodinsky, who's a professor and chair of the UVM Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And we also have with us Lisa Chase, Extension Professor and Director, Vermont Tourism Research Center, and Jane, I was just going to ask you the questions of the let's see here, trying to read my notes. okay, in terms of the work of your office to work with the Extension Service and with agriculture around Vermont, are you seeing that we're going to have long-term changes in the way Vermont's agricultural sector actually performs in the future?
Well, you know, I don't have a crystal ball and I can't predict, but my team that has been looking at local food and the possibility of more direct to consumer has the hypothesis that yes, indeed, that we believe that shorter supply chains for food are going to be really popular now and into the future as consumers realize that the food is available, it's trustworthy, and it's affordable.
And if somehow suddenly the national food distribution system were to go away and we were suddenly told that all of the food we're going to consume has to be raised within 100 miles of where we live, could Vermont survive that way?
Right now, I don't think so. But what we're seeing is that our local farmers certainly are gearing up and rising to the challenge. We're not ready nor able to satisfy a population of over 600,000 people. But as a supplement and perhaps as a substitute for some larger food systems, absolutely, it seems that that's the direction we're going in. And that's good news for Vermont consumers, and it's good news for Vermont businesses and farmers.
If you were to draw a chart and say, we are able currently and then projected to in 2025 or 2030 or pick a year, satisfy the food needs of Vermont, just as I just described. I mean, let's imagine we're on an island here or something and there's no imported food anymore. And if you were to deliver a bar chart saying that right now we could feed, I don't know, maybe 100,000 of our 630,000 people, or 50,000 or 200,000, whatever it is, what would be the number that bar would extend to?
Oh, I can't make any predictions, right? That would depend on whether or not consumer demand for food changes. You know, we don't grow coffee in Vermont. We don't grow pineapples in Vermont, that's for sure.
Yep,
so we would
yep.
have to see a huge shift in consumer tastes as well as in production. But I don't predict we can meet 100% of the demand. And I'll turn over to Lisa to see what she says.
What do you think, Lisa? about this question of how much of Vermont's food consumption could be satisfied. In other words, if we suddenly were in this, you know, it would be a dramatic situation and one which would be, frankly, probably viewed as an emergency. But if somehow Vermont were cut off from importing food from more than 100 miles away, would we, you know, to what extent would we be able to feed our populace here?
I think it's an excellent question and one that we don't have a good answer to right now, but one that we should be examining because, you know, whether it's the coronavirus or weather or, you know, disease or all sorts of other kinds of disruptions that take place, you know, typically the disruptions to our food supply chain have been more localized. And it's been, you know, relatively easy for other, you know, other businesses and producers and the chain to kind of flex and adapt. Now that we're seeing things on a national and even international level, we're really in an unprecedented era of trying to understand what is the resilience in our food supply and how do we, for the future, develop something that is more flexible and can handle these sorts of disruptions. And I have to say this focus on local producers feeding their communities is one of the few bright spots that we're seeing with the coronavirus.
Yeah, I think it might be an interesting measure there. I don't know whether this is something that could be kind of attacked in an academic study by you folks, but. You know, people have come up with weird and different charts on many different informational goals in mind. And you know, I mean, everything from the doomsday clock to, I don't know, any number of other things. And it would just be, I think, kind of a worthwhile public education exercise to say, you know, given the current state of Vermont agriculture, here is, and we were all suddenly, as I say, on this island or something. Here's how we would do, and then you could kind of chart that over time and say, are we improving on that front? Are we slipping? That sort of thing might be an interesting exercise just for people to wrap their minds around the degree to which we can rely on local food production here in Vermont to take care of our needs. Just a thought, but let me ask Danielle, what do you think? I mean, you're somebody who is in the business of providing locally grown produce to mostly Vermonters, I would gather, also maybe some New Hampshire folks on the other side of the river there. But talk to us a little about your thoughts of how close we could get to feeding our general population.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we think about it quite a lot. I mean, it's really on the top of my mind, even just today, as I had 10 or more customers calling and emailing me saying they want to sign up for our CSA, and we're turning people away, and it's heartbreaking. It's really hard to say we don't have space, we can't grow enough food for everybody. And so, you know, we just don't have the capacity. We only have so much land, and we've been keeping ourselves, you know, our staff small because it's another way that we can keep ourselves safe and stay healthy. And so there's sort of a tough piece of it where the demand is suddenly spiking, but, you know, that we need more farmers, basically. We need more farmers. And I think they're like leading up to the pandemic, there was always so much talk about how the market is saturated and there's no more room for more local food or more local farms, and there's so much competition in the Upper Valley. And I never really bought into that. I don't agree. And I feel like, you know, that we, you know, Vermonters are only consuming a small portion of their food from locally grown sources. And so, I think that there's room to grow and more farmers, you know, get access to land and get trained and skill, build their skill set so that we can grow more food for Vermonters.
Well, Jane, Danielle, I got to tell you, Jane said a few moments ago that, of course, Vermont doesn't grow coffee. If you could figure out a way to grow coffee on your farm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge point right there.
I can't survive without coffees.
Yeah, so. You know, I mean, to rely on a 100% Vermont diet is an extraordinary shift in consumer demand for, we can't, there's more than just coffee. We can't really grow grain on any large scale here either. So, you know, throw bread out the window or at least not on this, on the level that we consume so many things right now. And, our diet is really not focused in a seasonal way. And there, it would be an enormous change in our dietary preferences.
Intake. I must say, years ago when I was working as a reporter for the Associated Press, I went and interviewed a woman in Danby who was growing limes in a greenhouse. And I remember, I mean, that still kind of cracks me up when I think about citrus in Vermont. And I said, well, okay, we'll be able to make a gin and tonic, but not yet have a cup of coffee. So that's maybe that's I don't know whether that's good or bad or somewhere sideways, but tell me a little bit about. I mean, your sense of that must be frustrating for you, Danielle. Your sense of not being able to meet the demand that is being put on you right now. But we were recently talking about, I think, on this segment about the idea of folks getting into gardening at home. Yep. People talk about victory gardens and so on and so forth. So if the organic farmers step up to, the Danielle Allens of the world step up to their maximum production, and folks start to and after this, I'm going to stop hammering on this point because I it's sort of fascinating to me. That's why I've been sticking with it. But imagine that all the home gardeners in the state finally got off their duffs and went out there and actually started growing some vegetables in their yards. And how close could we get then? I mean, I know I can't really look for a numerical or percentage, but I mean, would that get us a lot closer, a little closer to satisfying our food needs, or would it make an impact?
Well, Dave, this is Jane, and I think if this is an interesting segment, our folks at Farm to Plate have been looking at this, and I'm sure that Ellen Kaler would have something to say about this and the chart and all those things. Mm-hmm. This is what they do. They're trying to increase the local production. I would say we would definitely be drinking more milk and eating more cheese and yogurt. Because what did I just read? I just read that Vermont dairy farmers are now going to send their milk to the food bank. So, we can gear up in certain places. That's for sure.
That is for sure. And I don't know whether we're ever going to get the coffee growing in greenhouses or whatever, but I might have to go into business myself if nobody else is trying it, because I got to have coffee. I'm sorry. It's just, let's see here.
You can have a lime in your Christmas stocking. How about that?
Okay, that's good to know. Better than a lump of cola, which we also don't have any of in Vermont, so I don't know. Let's see here. One of the raps that I hear about a lot of locally grown organic produce and farmers markets, et cetera, is that their prices are too high. The average Vermonter out there, many of them say, I can't afford to pay, $5 for a head of lettuce or something like that. What's your take on that? Danielle, I'll start with you.
I think that's a perception issue that, when we look at our prices and compare them to grocery store prices, we don't see a huge difference. So I think there is sort of a stigma there that is not really based in reality, is my opinion. But that's not to say that it's not, I mean, it's worth addressing. It's worth looking at and examining. And I guess maybe if consumers were looking more at nutrition and calories in nutrition per dollar that they spend, they would probably see that, spending money on organic vegetables was an investment in their own health and their longevity, and those kinds of things. But we're not doing those calculations. So,
Jane, let me ask you, Jane Kolodinsky, your sense and what you're hearing. I mean, obviously you study this stuff a lot more closely than I do, or I think than the average folks out there in Vermont do on a daily basis. And that is, What about the national food system? Is it in good shape? Is it in teetering shape? Is it in on the brink of what is it they used to say in that old song, the eve of destruction?
Wow, there's so much I could say on this. Let me organize my thoughts. First, let me follow up to Danielle and say, you know, you asked about organic food. Well, not all local food has to be organic. So
true. Yeah. Okay.
The price difference, and this is where we get into the national food system. We have been really raised and pushed on large food systems that are extremely efficient until they're not. And the word has been called fragile. So it's not that there isn't enough food being produced. It's that the fragility comes in with efficiency at all costs. And what we're finding is that when some of the processing is all centralized, such as we're seeing in the meat industry, or we see disruptions in transportation, which disrupt the supply chain so that our cheap food, which is grown in other places at a huge scale, cannot get to our market. That's what we're seeing. Farmers are producing, all sizes and scales of farmers are producing, but it's the local farmers who are able to, because of the short supply chain, able to get their product to the consumer. So it's not that there's not enough food, it's that the supply chains are being disrupted big time. And so I think it's time for us to question efficiency at all costs, and that is becoming a national conversation right now.
Boy, you know, I do see some commonality here between this segment of our economy, which is a huge and important segment, and the overall economy, because one question I've been trying to figure out how to get my mind around is, before the pandemic hit, we were hearing a lot from our president and others, certainly folks defending him, that, you know, one of his strongest suits has been the economic performance of the United States. But boy, now you look at the situation and I'm not sure whether this could have been avoided to some extent or to a great extent or what, but certainly this pandemic, which some people described as not that much worse than the flu, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that, but this pandemic has basically been able to just blow our economy over. And I mean, talk about fragility. It's kind of amazing when you think about, you know, all the talk of strength of our economy 4 or 5 months ago, and now the devastation of our economy because of this one admittedly terrifically difficult issue. I don't know. I hope that people could figure out a way to maybe make the economy not only strong but more resilient going into the future. But we'll see if that ever unfolds. I digress, however. I'm wondering in the Jane, if you can tell me in terms of consumer behavior, what about the perception out there among some Vermonters? Though I was, you know, that question I was asking Danielle about the price difference and organic. Yes, the organic fetches a premium in the national food chain for sure, and as well as I suspect the local one. But I'm wondering, do you feel as though there is a perception issue then to overcome?
I absolutely do. A lot of the studies that have been done, and not necessarily with organic, but even with local food, have been on the price per pound or something like that, which absolutely doesn't make sense. If you are purchasing local food in terms of seasonal local food, so right now we're still finishing up our cabbages and carrots from winter storage, right? We shouldn't be expecting, and maybe our apples from storage, but we certainly shouldn't be expecting strawberries from Vermont in April and May. It just doesn't exist. So there would have to be a huge shift, as we've been discussing, in our diet to learn how to eat seasonally and to change our tastes to adjust. And then I think that you'll see that it's not necessarily more expensive. But again, it also deals with the efficiency issue that we have been able to have a cheap food system because
we have relied on that efficiency at all costs. And again, we go back to the fragility of that. So I think we're at a turning point in terms of thinking about our own food security and our own food system and how big that food system should be overall, or whether it should be more regionalized and localized to the extent that it can be. And so I think we're having those conversations and answering those questions now. And in Vermont, the answer is yes, we have turned to our local and regional farmers to fill in the gap.
Lisa, I wanted to ask you, because of your expertise in the tourism realm, I had an interesting conversation with a state senator on the program last week, I believe it was, who was saying that he is worried about any effort that might come down the pipe to reopen Vermont's lodging industry anytime soon. Because most of the visitors to Vermont who come up and stay in our beds, our bed and breakfasts, and our hotels and so on, are people from places where there's a lot more COVID-19 around, New York, Boston, Connecticut, et cetera. And what do you make of that? Is that something that you think will put a damper on the tourism industry in for months to come, or do you think that we need to push to get it open, or where are we on all that?
The future of the tourism industry in Vermont and around the globe is very uncertain right now. You know, what we are seeing, though, is as travel begins to open up, it will be focused much more locally than before. So it will begin with Vermonters traveling within Vermont, going from, Brattleboro to Burlington or vice versa. And then it will gradually open up within nearby states. And it will be quite some time before international travel and, even national travel across the country really picks up to where it will be. And we see that, we see that on the business side, with businesses feeling more comfortable about more localized travel, but also on the consumer side, people are concerned about going to crowded places and traveling long distances. So I think in terms of positioning, Vermont and our farms that are open to visitors, when it does become safe to travel again, agritourism, visiting farms, whether they're, just up the road or, a few towns over, or whether it's a few states over, I think that's going to be one of the experiences that people are able to comfortably offer and engage in sooner rather than later. I want to make one quick comment on, you were talking about economic performance before.
Sure,
I feel like one thing that Vermont does so well is focus not just on the economic piece, but looking at our natural environment and issues of social sustainability as well. And we really have to look at all three dimensions when we talk about sustainability and resilience moving forward.
Well, that is a great note to end this conversation on, which I have to do because we're about out of time. Lisa Chase, Extension Professor and Director of Vermont Tourism Research Center. Jane Kolodinsky, Professor and Chair, UVM Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And Danielle Allen, a farmer from Fairley, Vermont. I want to thank the three of you very much. Excellent conversation today, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Alrighty, that's going to about do it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. And I really appreciate all you listeners out there and the phone calls you chip in with. And it's always good talking to folks. We'll do it again tomorrow about 9:05. And don't be shy about calling in then either. Meanwhile, don't forget our podcast. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayers of the Common Sense Radio Show. I think Rob Roper's sitting in for Bill. Have a great afternoon, everybody.